And it was wrapped, and I was unwrapping it. And I heard this gasp, and I looked up, and I saw this horrified look on my daughter's face, and she said, "I never saw that." On the front of the cup, it said, "There's no better father than you." That's pretty impressive. The other side of the cup says, "There's no better friend than a father." And I guess I learned that day that I wasn't my daughter's best friend. But it makes me wonder, how do you buy a cup and not know what it says on it? Right? I guess you didn't check it out. And to see if it's really what you wanted to say. And actually, Jesus uses this idea in Luke 14, verse 28. It says, "For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, to see if he has enough to complete it?" Now, a tower was a pretty handy item in those days. One of its main purposes was for defense. You could put your watchmen way up in the air and they could see who was coming. If somebody did come to attack you, they had to shoot up. You had to shoot down, right? You locked the doors, you're pretty safe inside. And the way you typically besieged the tower was you build a siege mount, which is basically a built a hill. And then you were taller. And you could keep pushing rocks and dirt over the front until finally you're had a path right into the top of their tower. In Judges 9, there's a guy that tried a different approach, Abimelech. He hauled a bunch of wood and placed it around the tower, and he lit it on fire. And it tells us that everybody in the tower of Shechem died. So he went and tried it at the next place, at Sebez. Only there was some brilliant lady there, and when he come up hauling wood up, she dropped a millstone on him. And that was the end of Abimelech. Tower had another thing to it too, though. It was kind of a status symbol. It said that you had something that was worth defending, right? So if you didn't figure out if you could finish this tower, you had this monstrosity half built to remind you and everybody in the neighborhood that you weren't quite as important as you thought you were. Or as my mother-in-law would always say, "You got too big for your britches." Verse 31 gives another illustration. It says, "Or what king, as he goes to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends an envoy and asks conditions of peace." So what kind of questions would you ask yourself? Like, can I win? And if I do win, at what cost? The lives that are lost, the maimed and wounded that are going to wander around my kingdom afterwards, the widows, the fatherless children. What about the supplies I have to expend to win this? And if I do win, will I have enough left over to control what I've won and what I had before? And so he said, you can send an envoy. And the envoy can, he has to negotiate with the other king, because the other king has to ask himself the same questions. What do I want out of this? Why am I here? And can I accept the costs that are going to be there? Again, the wounded people, the maimed people, people that are missing from my kingdom, and the widows and the fatherless children. And then again, if I do beat them, can I live? Can I still look after the place, and can I live with those costs? And so you have a negotiation, and maybe you'll come to an agreement, maybe you won't, but. Jesus is using this concept of checking things out when they were challenged to follow Jesus. We need to consider the costs and if we're willing to pay it. Because you might have to change some things. You might have to give up some things, and you're definitely going to have to exercise some discretion. And this is not just a one-time happening. This is not a one-time decision, because the dynamics around us are continually changing. There are things that were acceptable and normal practice when I was a kid that are now totally unacceptable. Some of them should be that way, and there's others that shouldn't. But when you accept Jesus Christ, it's going to change the dynamics in your life. If you come from a family that was into, and I love the word used in the story of the prodigal son, if you're into a family that's into riotous living, you're not a part of that anymore. There are some people whose friends are into, whose family are into criminal activity, and suddenly you became a threat to your family because you're not participating anymore. The same thing happens with your friends. There's a saying, birds of a feather flock together, but unfortunately you have changed your spots, right? And things don't work the way they did. I mentioned these guys that got together down at Longview. They had to change what they did for a living. When they accept Christ, a friend of mine, a guy I met not too long ago in Olds, he made his living playing the bars. And you can't do that anymore. And some of us know other people that have done that. And unfortunately, this also applies to the church we attend. Because some churches are changing their stance on things. They're going to non-biblical stands. And I remember a number of years ago, I was picking up some tryout horses down at Strathmore Rodeo Grounds. The guy had brought them, a guy by the name of Bruce Flewelling, who was a pickup man in Calgary for many years. And he came up to me and he asked me, he says, I don't know, my mother doesn't know what to do. She's been part of a church for years and now they're accepting things that have been wrong all her life. What does she do? Well, our faith is not in our church. Our faith is in Jesus Christ and we have to follow him. And so some of the things that have been part of our life, or it might have to change. And the interesting part about it is if they don't freeze you out, I mean, if you don't leave, they're going to freeze you out, right? I mean, how many times can you sit in a bar and witness to your friends about Jesus Christ before you realize that you're there to be with your friends? You're not there to necessarily witness for Jesus Christ. You may be doing that, but the reason that you're there is because of your friends. And the reason that they're going to freeze you out, it's given to us in 2 Corinthians 2:16. It says that we're the stench of death to them. Now that may be a funny concept, but in Psalms 19:1-3, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The expanse shows his handiwork. Day after day they pour out speech, and night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Romans 1:20 sums that all up and says that God's creation has revealed everything about him, right? And when you take the fact that people know there is a God, although they might worship the creation rather than the creator, we're told that, but they know there's a God, and in Ecclesiastes 3:1, it tells us that God has set eternity in the hearts of men, right? Every human soul has the awareness that there's something. That's why people vehemently oppose the gospel. They'll sit and listen to conspiracy theories, and they might get tired of hearing them, but they won't kick you out, tell you to shut up maybe, but they won't stop coming to see you because they know. And you are the stench of death, their death. They know. So, are you willing to pay the price? And are you willing to continue paying it as you go through your life? Deuteronomy 6:5 says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. That really doesn't leave you much for anything else, does it? But the amazing thing is, we're told in John 7:37-38, that if we come to Jesus, if we come drink from him, from within our innermost being shall flow springs of living water. We become God's cistern, and we can give out way more than we ever had before. If you're not willing to pay the price, we become part three of the parable of the seed and the sower. That's where the seed fell among the thorns. And in Luke 18, verse 14, when Jesus is explaining this to his disciples, he says, "These are the ones that hear, but as they go along, worries and wealth and life's gratifications crowd in and choke them so that their fruit never matures." Then the joy of our salvation becomes religion, and religion becomes a chore. We have a form of godliness, but we have no power. We've lost it. And we've lost our joy, therefore we've lost our strength. Nehemiah 8:10 tells us that the joy of the Lord is our strength. And the words of the Bible just become dead letter. They're just words, stories. No longer alive. It no longer inspires us. And we become lukewarm. And then we're an abomination to God. Revelation 3:16, he tells it, "Because you are lukewarm, I will spew you out of your mouth." I think of somebody that has to sneeze when they have a mouth of coffee, and you hope you can get your hand over your cup in time. Another translation says, "I will vomit you out." And I think of those times when I'm sick and I'm heaved everything up that's within me, and my body's still contracting, and I'm trying to throw up stuff that's not even there anymore. After Nathan the prophet confronted David, David repented and he prayed, and as part of his prayer, I'm going to read out of Psalms 51:12. He says, "Don't throw me from your presence, and don't take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of my salvation. Uphold me with a willing spirit." That's a spirit that's willing to accept the cost. It is my prayer that each one of us is willing to pray that prayer. Uphold me with a willing spirit to accept and to count the cost and stay with it.